And night will come for us all.
Hey, Samantha, where can they find us on the social medias?
I am so glad you asked. They can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Reaper Tales Podcast and on TikTok at reaper.tales.podc. Just PODC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can email us at reapergals@reapertales.com. I'm always looking at it. So if you're one of the ones that emails me on a regular basis, you know that. I do respond almost in real time, unless like
almost.
I'm on vacation or like I'm bed rotting, but that's a different thing. So email us at reapergals, G-A-L-S, at reapertales.com. Email me to tell me that I look pretty. Email me to tell me I'm doing a good job and to send us your show suggestions and anything else that you want us to cover or anything like that. So, yeah.
And please remember to like, rate, review, subscribe, all the things you lovely listeners know what to do anyway on any of the listening platforms that you use. As per usual, you get bonus points if you do it on platforms you don't listen to us on, but you give us a nice little review. And worded reviews will get special shout outs. So if you are so inclined to do so, please do us a favor. Makes it a little easier for people to find us. And if you don't want to be listed out, by the way, on the worded reviews, it's too bad. We're still going to give you a shout out.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you say we smell like boogers or something like that. Okay, thanks.
Rude.
Hello, I'm Montana.
And I'm Samantha.
And you're listening to
Reaper Tales. And today I'm going to tell Montana about the history of the land for the Birmingham Botanical Gardens and Zoo and the attractions themselves. But before I get started, Montana, what are we drinking? Or not drinking, technically. What is our drink pairing?
Our drink pairing is the Elephant's Mud Bath. It's 1 ounce of vodka, 1 ounce of cream de coco, and 1 ounce of Amarula cream liqueur. You're going to blend it with some ice and pour it into a glass. It says a shot glass, but you could probably do it in like a martini glass or something like that.
If you want to get fancy.
But if you want a mocktail, basically just make a cold hot chocolate with more milk. And there you have it.
So ta-da.
Since we're on a not drinking kick today, I still have my mocktail from Conspiracies. So cheers.
Yes. And I have like a basically mocktail margarita, but it's just lemonade, Sprite, and strawberry, sugar-free strawberry syrup. So it still works though. It gets me through. All right. So Montana, are you ready to hear about what we got going on today?
You know I am. I freaking love the zoo, man. And especially like the Birmingham Zoo, because like I said before we started recording, I used to volunteer there a lot for a couple of years. And they had a really good volunteer program where the more hours you put in, like different levels you got for like handling animals. Because when you first start, you're not handling animals like at all. You're just doing like kind of helpful stuff around. But the more time and experience you get, it went like birds, then birds and reptiles, then birds, reptiles, you know, mammals, large mammals. So the longer you stayed on the program, the more animals you got to interact with. So I thought they had a really cool system going. Cool stuff, bro.
I don't know if it's still the same way. It very well may be. But I do remember they used to ask for volunteers all the time for the two events that they do every year, the Zoo Light Safari for Christmas, and then the...
Yep, did that several times.
Boo at the Zoo that they do, which is... that is an amazing program because, I mean, they have volunteers set up with candy buckets throughout the zoo so the kids can go through the zoo and they get to go like trick-or-treating basically, but they get to be dressed up in their costumes and it's a lot of fun.
It was
a really good way to get the kids involved.
I did that. And then for the Zoo Light Safari, I was in one of two places when I volunteered for that. I was either in like the kids rooms where they did like crafts, or I was stationed at the train crossing because they had a train that goes through the zoo and you can see all the lights on the train. And what we would do at the end of the night is all of the volunteers would get on the train and we would do the ride ourselves alone so we could see it for ourselves. It was fun.
It's only fair.
It was a lot of fun.
Well, I will say, you know, if I'm covering this on an episode of this podcast, there must be something interesting going on. So before we get started, what do you think is going to be involved in today's episode about the land and the attractions themselves? Wild guess.
Since you sent the picture and we had the argument about territories and Appalachians being a part of it, I'm gonna say that moonshining is involved.
That's a good guess. Want to guess anything else? Or is that your final answer?
Well, I was going to say the land was probably stolen or something like that, but like all land in the United States was stolen. So kind of like a given. It's the South. So anything from like slavery to like, and that's not funny. It's just like, I have a it's, big bucket to pull from here.
Yeah.
Is it going to be like a wild thing or is it like a common thing?
Interesting distinction. It's kind of both.
Marijuana fields? I don't know.
No, I'll actually say no to that. Okay, so let's see how close or far away you were. Okay. We'll just go ahead and get started. So I wasn't able to find out much of anything about this area until about 1822. And at that time, 79.88 acres was granted by the United States to a military veteran, William Pullen, who was a Revolutionary War veteran and one of the early settlers of Jefferson County, Alabama. Pullen fought under Washington's command at Brandywine, Monmouth, Germantown, and Guilford, CH, and was encamped at Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, in the winter of 1777 through 78.
Oh, wow.
After his 7 years of service, he reached the rank of lieutenant, according to BehamWiki.com. When he was granted the land in 1822, he farmed it until his death in 1845. It was left to his heirs, who then sold it to the city of Birmingham in 1889. 29.98 acres of this land was apparently granted to Joseph Byers in 1855, and this is a different plot of land, but I was unable to locate any more details about the grant or Joseph himself. It was also sold to, and this plot of land was also sold to the city of Birmingham by 1889. According to the records I was able to pull, the sales were in pieces. It was a total of 200 acres, and it was sold in three parcels. In September 1896, February 1889, and 1902. So the total amount of the land is 200 acres.
Okay.
So after this time, the city of Birmingham decided to establish the land a cemetery in February of 1893.
Oh, no.
Quote, on the west side of the road to be used as a potter's field in connection with the nearby pest houses. Since only Cahaba Road existed at the time, the records imply that only the area within current Birmingham Zoo Lane Park was built in 1939 in this location. The report states that the cemetery was abandoned in 1909 when the Katona Potter's Field was opened and that the 4,767 graves were left in place. There has been local speculation that some of the graves were moved to the Union Cemetery on Hollywood Boulevard, but no records support this. Note the first burials were July of 1999, and the actual count that can be accounted for is 4,711 burials. Now you know the direction we're going.
What the fuck?
When you were having her guess, I was like, I bet it's going to be haunted. That was my guess.
That's a good guess. Pest houses were maintained in this area possibly from 1873 until World War I, when they were burned, according to Dr. George Eubank's daughter, Mrs. Al C. Garber Sr., to whom I spoke. This is a quote from the article that I have in the show notes, whom I spoke to in 1975. Dr. Eubanks cared for the patients at the pest house. His 55-acre farm was located approximately where the west course of the Birmingham Country Club is now. His driveway began on Cahaba Road, which at that time was a dirt road, and ran through the present plaza of the Birmingham Botanical Gardens and what is now North Lane in Mountain Brook, which is not far away from where I used to live.
No, it's not. Also, that country club.
Yeah.
Been there. Been to the pool there. Had a drink there. That place is fancy.
It's very fancy.
We're not talking it's a country. It's like old school country club. It is fancy as fuck, my guy.
Spared no expense.
No, I did not fit in. That's for sure.
I wasn't going to say it.
Oh, boy.
Dr. Charles Whelan is also listed as a pest house physician in the interment records of Red Mountain Cemetery, which is what this cemetery was called. The pest houses are also mentioned in the 1905 report of the sexton of Red Mountain Cemetery.
Did you say what a pest house is?
Quick note, from what I can tell, the term pest house was used for victims. No, I was going to get to that because it sounds awful.
Bugs? We're talking bugs?
From what I can tell, the term pest house was used for victims of diseases that live together to keep infection and or transmission as low as possible. Obviously, this was more than likely also only the poorest of the population, so conditions in these houses were abysmal, I'm sure.
They weren't even trying.
No. These people were not sent to these houses to get better, but to stay until they died from their diseases. It also seems that some of those buried were victims of violence, county convicts who were executed, and poor people who died of diseases or other causes that did not arrange or did not have the funds to arrange for their own burial.
Oh my God. They just put your pests here, your bothersome sick relative. Bring them here and we'll let them die in squalor and terrible conditions where you don't have to see it.
Keep in mind, this is the early 1900s, so we're not talking 1700s, 1600s. This is early 1900s.
They had hospitals.
So
they had
only just over 100 years ago.
Good Lord.
By 1905, the land seems to have still been used for burials, though the land had begun to be overgrown and trees were getting thick enough that the plots were considered forested. It's believed the burial plots were limited to a 6-acre section of the 200-plus acre lot. There was also a smallpox hospital located on the property for a time, as well as a small rock quarry. After 1909, though, the burials of the poor residents were to take place at Katona, leaving this plot of land largely abandoned to the wilds that were overtaking it. In 1910, a tent city was erected as a TB sanatorium, so to aid tuberculosis victims in North Alabama. It was located at the east end of Park Place in the northeast upper area of the Birmingham Botanical Gardens. There is a historical marker at the corner of Park Lane and Cahaba Road marking this. In 1934, after over 4 years of campaigning, Mayor George B. Ward was successful in designating the area known as Red Mountain Park officially as Lane Park in honor of Judge Alexander Oscar Lane, who had served as mayor of Birmingham for 4 terms, circuit court judge from 1907 to 1911, and was a member of the city commission from 1911 to 1915. According to BhamWiki.com, quote, in 1934, at the urging of Mayor George B. Ward, the 200-acre property was irrevocably dedicated as a city park, named in honor of A.O. Lane, who had promoted the city's purchase. Ward was quoted as saying, as a beautiful breathing spot, its possibilities are even manifest to the ghosts of the pauper dead who now look out on the mansions of the millionaire and mayhap grin to think that all things come to those who wait, and that the whirligig of time has transmuted their lowly beds into nooks of safety and beauty.
No.
I don't think they're happy about it. You can put it however you want.
No. By all accounts, these people died because of capitalism. and the greed of the rich, you really think that they're going to look out and think, boy, howdy, you know, back in my day, it was a death house for the sick and unwanted. But now I'm so happy that it is full of rich and safe people. No, no.
Sorry, no.
Nice try.
We tried. In 1935, Thomas Brooks, a landscape designer for the WPA, worked with the Birmingham Federation of Garden Clubs that sponsored the planting of over 5,000 trees and shrubs to form Lane Park Arboretum, I think is how you say it, which covered a portion of the current zoo. The work and expenses are documented in a copy of his report to the WPA in 1938, but does not mention anything about graves in the area. Discussions regarding the development and creation of the Birmingham Zoo began in 1946 when Elton B. Stevens chaired a committee and continued through 1949. A zoo commission was established, and the ultimate decision was made to build the zoo with a budget of $250,000 and using 50 of the 200 acres available. According to BirminghamZoo.com, quote, the budget would be spent to build Monkey Island, an elephant house, bear moat, bird house, snake pit, and seal pool. Funds were raised through private donations, charter memberships, and in-kind donations from a broad base of community and business supporters. Monkey Island, the zoo's first official exhibit, was dedicated on April 2, 1955. The Birmingham Zoo operated as a quasi-private venture until the City Commission decided to assume responsibility in November of 1955, with an initial annual budget of $663,000. Some years later, the Birmingham Zoological Society was created to raise funds to supplement the escalating zoo needs, end quote. So now we have the Birmingham Zoo Botanical Garden still isn't here. The rest of the land's basically just still the way that it is.
Mm-hmm. It's in an awkward place, honestly. Like, yeah, it's great that there was all this land that was like around it and that helped make up it. But you've got on one side, you've got that little town, the little Mountain Brook.
Yeah, that's English. That's English the Mountain Village. Brook Village, I think. English Village is higher up.
And then on the other side, you have the Red Mountain Expressway and like 280. Mm-hmm. It's like when you go to like, typically when you go to a zoo, you know, outside of like the major cities, like Atlanta, I'm assuming, like in North Carolina, that zoo is out of the way. Like it is out of the way. Birmingham Zoo is like right in the middle of
smack dab
a city. Like it's weird for sure.
Well, they had these extra yardage that they weren't using, so why not?
And but I mean, like Louisville Zoo is right in their downtown too, I guess. It's a weird place to put a zoo, you know. You want to have a lot more land and things like that, and just the upscaleness of that area is not very inviting to people of a lower class anyway. So no. Again,
not so much.
Weird place.
Well, and it only gives so much room for expansion, right? Because I mean, 200 acres is what they had to work with, and they only used 55. So that's, or 50, that's a very small amount of land, honestly, for a zoo.
And that zoo is small.
It is. It was in 1961 that Mayor James W. Morgan was able to come to an agreement to construct the botanical gardens on 69 acres of Lane Park on the south side of Red Mountain. By this time, other botanical gardens had already been built across the country, and Morgan wanted to use the other locations for inspiration. Visiting Montreal's botanical gardens and meeting the curator, Dr. Henry E. Toucher, I guess, who Morgan asked to design the plan for Birmingham's gardens. Plants were brought in from all over the world, including Frankfurt, Germany, Montreal, and Niagara, Canada, and Asheville, North Carolina. The gardens opened in 1963 and included a conservatory that allowed many tropical plants to live that otherwise would not have been possible, like coconut, banana, vanilla, coffee, cacao, and tropical species of palms and tree ferns. It now has an entire section of desert plants as well. And you have to realize, too, back then, these these were things that people could not easily be able to see. So this is all very novel. This is all stuff that Birmingham residents at the time, they would have never been able to see these things up and up close and personal like that.
It took me a minute, but I was like, why would Asheville help them with their botanical gardens? And I completely forgot about the Biltmore House and its botanical gardens, like the one of the most historic places in North Carolina. Oh my God.
Oops. 1964, Birmingham Post-Herald, quote, May 23rd, 1964, reported that workmen removing dirt from a spot near the new rose garden of the botanical gardens had uncovered at least three graves facing east, and the bones of one skeleton was fairly well preserved. Other items retrieved were flint chips, a couple of copper items similar to shoelace tips, a small fastener as used on ladies' apparel, and a broken bottle with the raised letters Birmingham. Signs of a wooden casket were plainly visible. No information has been found as to what action was taken, end quote. And I saw other articles that said they weren't sure if those were human remains.
It's pretty, okay.
They knew. Nice try.
What kind of animal do you think was wearing those shoes, my friends?
Yeah, well, you know, deny. In 1965, the project to build the Japanese gardens began. The two architects that developed the garden were Darcy Tatum and I am so sorry because I'm not going to say this right, Masaji Buffy Murai. The tea garden was brought to the gardens from the New York World's Fair thanks to an agreement reached between the U.S. Senator John Sparkman and the Japanese ambassador. After much work, the Japanese gardens were opened to the public May 6, 1967, with a ceremony led by the Japanese ambassador. These gardens covered 7.5 acres of land. In the early 1990s, the tea house was in dire need of repair, and they used as much of the original tea house as possible, as well as new pieces made from materials from Japan, in order to construct a new tea house designed by one of the original designers named, and I'm really sorry because I'm probably going to butcher this, Kazunori Tago in Japan. So they sent the materials to Japan. They actually redid the whole design in Japan. And then once the new tea house was completed, it was disassembled, sent back to Birmingham, where it was reassembled and still stands today, as far as I can tell.
I do like that they did it that way. And they didn't just like culturally appropriate, you know, Japanese culture and things like that. They actually got them to design it and things like that. So they did do one thing right there. Good for them.
They were trying, I think. Yeah. They really wanted, again, it's people in Birmingham, the majority of people of Birmingham are never going to be able to visit Japan to see anything authentic there. So to bring a little bit of their culture here so that we can see it and see the beauty of it. And they have worked really hard on that garden to keep it well kept and to maintain the upkeep. So I will certainly give that to them. Again, from birminghamzoo.com, quote, during the ensuing decades, the city of Birmingham had many needs more important in human terms than the zoo. Such was the case with many municipal zoos, and Birmingham was no different. Funding for the zoo was inadequate to maintain and operate it at acceptable professional standards. A series of master plans were developed, but never came to fruition due to lack of funding. The need for significant improvements became increasingly evident by the 1990s. With so many financial demands on the city taking precedence and no leadership when it was needed most, the zoo lost its accreditation by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is the AZA. Mm-hmm. In 1999, Mayor Richard Arrington led the way for the privatization of the zoo, recruiting strong community leaders to serve as the first board of directors of a new organization, the Birmingham Zoo, Inc. The new organization established a transitional funding package with contributions from four government entities to support BZI during its first 5 years of operation. BZI is now in its 19th fiscal year. That would have been 1999, so this was written like 2018, I guess. 2018, 2019. So at the time it was written its 19th fiscal year as a private nonprofit organization. An intense 18-month effort addressed the most pressing and immediate problems so that the zoo could become accredited by the AZA once again. ranking the zoo in the top 10% of animal holding facilities in the nation. The zoo also received 501c3 status from the IRS, and the zoo's first major capital campaign was launched in January of 2001. In 2006, the zoo was ranked as the number one tourist attraction in the state of Alabama. Boy, has it come a long way, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I actually remember the zoo from way back then, because I moved to Alabama in like 95, and that was one of the first places we went to, and it was not so great. But, you know, within a few years, I feel like I remember it having like a grand reopening, and we went the following year because it was way too busy that first year. And it was really amazing. I was pretty impressed. The funding has not remained where it needs to be, though.
Yeah. And it has gone through like transformations over time, because I do, like you said, I do remember going to the zoo as a kid, and it was much smaller, not much smaller. The enclosures were less accommodating for animals. It wasn't as fun to look at, like be a part of, because of the conditions. And then to go back later in life and like volunteer, they had obviously put a lot of thought and effort into getting it back up to a standard that is enjoyable. I mean, the enclosures are still very small in comparison to a place like the North Carolina Zoo, but there's a lot more care and thought and conservation put into that effort then. I don't know where it's at now.
Yeah, and I think, too, we're always learning, right? So we're always trying to do better and trying to learn how to better take care of those that are under our care. So animals have been something that it's constantly being updated, and the standards are, I'm sure, constantly being raised. The bar is constantly being raised, as it should be, because these animals are in our care and it's our responsibility to give them the best life possible. So that being said, that means zoos have a high responsibility to maintain those standards, and that costs money, and sometimes zoos just can't keep up with it. And that's why a lot of them have closed, whether for a period of time or permanently.
Yeah.
And Birmingham Zoo is not immune to that, obviously.
Well, the one thing I don't like is the privatization of the zoo. And I know that they were working towards getting back onto the AZA or whatever it was. But once something like that goes privatized, the standards of care drop because you're not being monitored. It's something that you see with like things like SeaWorld. That's a privately owned company. It's not like a conservation effort, you know, monitored by government agencies that force you to uphold a standard. And it makes me worried about animals and their
care. I think they still have to maintain a certain level of care, because I think they're still scrutinized whether they're private or not in this situation because of the fact that it is zoo animals. I think in order for them, I could be wrong, but I think in order for them to be able to have the animals they have and to be able to get other animals, they have to maintain a certain standard, or they're not going to be included as an option for other zoos to share their animals. And so that very much limits their ability to expand in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. Okay.
And as animals die, whether by, you know, just old age or other things, getting sick, they need to be able to replace those animals. So they have to have a certain level to be able to continue to, unfortunately, with lack of a better term, replenish the type of animals that they have.
Yeah. Okay. I just thought, like, because my thought is,
I feel
is
like that when I went to Atlanta, I think they mentioned that zoos have like a certain gradation that they have to reach and keep in order to be able to be included in like the pool of zoos to be able to get new animals from time to time.
Breeding programs and things like that.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. So I've got beef with SeaWorld. That's what it is. At the end of the day.
That's fair.
SeaWorld and I, if I ever see SeaWorld, it's on site. That's it.
Fair enough.
I'm going to throw hands.
From your 5'2" stature.
They're not going to be able to see you. SeaWorld. Just punching SeaWorld sign. Like, fuck you, man.
I don't doubt it.
Oh, God.
In 2007, the zoo launched its Sea Lion Splash show, sponsored by Red Diamond. Quote, "This wet, wild, and fun show features the comedic behavior of sea lions, such as talking, whispering, dancing, and special interactions with the audience," end quote.
Well, the intro to that could be,
right?
You know, a fun little Sea World show, or it could be the title of a porn video. So, whatever.
I don't even know what to do with that. So moving on. One major goal of the new show was to increase public awareness of the conservation of marine mammals. They also added an elephant exhibit, Trails of Africa, which designated Birmingham Zoo as a national leader in the care and conservation of threatened elephants.
They were building that when I was volunteering because it wasn't
open
yet.
The Trails of Africa?
Yeah.
And they have one of the best elephant exhibits, I think, still to this day.
Never got to see it.
They have quite a few. The exhibit also featured giraffes. Not how to say the term. I forgot to look it up before. It's D-U-I-K-E-R-S.
It's pronounced Duikers.
Duikers? Rhinos and lions. So in 2017, the zoo opened Asian Passage by renovating the existing predator building to highlight the following Asian species: the Malayan tiger, Komodo dragon, Sumatran orangutans, I don't know why I have a hard time with that, red pandas, pallas, cats, and fishing cats, along with others. It was designed to also include Asian architecture, music, and art, and allowed for the Sumatran orangutans to have a greater access to the outdoors and improve the viewing areas for the visitors to observe the animal care professionals and animals in their care.
Huh. I do like that it seems the zoos are kind of moving more towards like geographically laying out their animals, because I know North Carolina has the different continents. So they have like North America, Africa, Asia, and I guess Birmingham Zoo is doing it too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it works better that way, because you're learning two things at once. You're learning about animals, conservation, and you're also learning about where they actually come from.
And how diverse those areas can actually be. I mean, mm-hmm. putting all the tigers in one area, I mean, while it makes sense, it actually is, I do feel like it is more educational to have all of the animals from that area together, so you can see kind of similarities between the animals. Even when you're looking at reptiles, birds, and mammals, you can kind of see some similarities between them.
Yeah, and it's also kind of drives that line of, hey, this is where that animal is from, and we need to kind of keep it there, because integrating it into a different environment can be dangerous for that animal and the environment itself. So let's keep it where it's from, you know?
Yeah. And two, one thing that's interesting is they are also making the habitats more like the geographical location that the animals are from. So when you're in the African exhibits, it's hot. There's not a lot of shade, because that's what they would be used to. When you're in the more Asian area animal exhibit, it's usually a lot more shaded. You see a lot more bamboo and that sort of thing. So it's a little bit more like what they would be used to in their natural habitat. So it's more immersive too, because you're kind of feeling more like that location rather than we're just in Birmingham looking around at different animals.
Yeah. It's a cool thing. Just wanted to add my two cents.
And I really like, well, and that's one thing that I like is when they have the shows where you can actually go to see certain types of animals. Like, I know the Atlanta Zoo has one that is the birds of prey. And when you go into there, they show you different types of birds, and they show, you know, this is the talons are this way and the beak is this way. And this is why they are designed this way, because this is the type of food that they eat, or this is the location that they're in. I like that it's so much more educational than I remember it being when I was a kid. Rather than exhibit to exhibit and reading a placard, it's more interactive. Like, you get to see and experience more.
Well, that's what it was in the beginning. It was for entertainment. Like, it wasn't about education. It wasn't about conservation. It was about entertainment and money. And it was like circuses. Circuses aren't about, you know, being educational. They're about making money in the most cost-effective way. And I like that they've moved away from that mindset when it comes to zoos, because they do have a responsibility. If you are going to have these animals, you have a responsibility to educate people on it and to ensure, you know, the future of that species. So good job, Birmingham.
Absolutely. And I think it's also in waking up that desire for kids that might want to go into that line of work, because they desperately need people to be in that line of work, because they are running out of these of people that are well established and educated in this line of work, in the different areas of the animals, taking care of them, conservation, all of that. I mean, we're in dire need of people in those professions. So this is waking that up in kids as well. Because I remember that's what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wanted to be a veterinarian for zoo animals. Unfortunately, that did not happen. But that was my goal. And that I want to hear that kids still want to do that because they're desperately needed.
I wanted to be a box of cereal.
Sure. But you can still do that. I guess.
Oh, man.
Joke's on you. I'm going to give you that for your birthday one year. I'm going to have a box of cereal with your face put on it.
I really, growing up as a kid on Halloween, I don't know why I thought about this. I always wanted to go as a box of cereal for Halloween, but my mother wouldn't let me. I was a twin, so we had to do like twin costumes, and Mackenzie always wanted to be like Snow White or, you know, whatever. And I couldn't just be like the Beast from, you know.
So which of the dwarves were you?
Yeah, right. Well, actually, no, one year I was, we went as Raggedy Ann and Andy, and I was, no surprise, Andy. I was always the boy. But yeah, always wanted to be a box of cereal, almost dressed up as a box of cereal this past Halloween, just to live out that dream that I never got.
Every year is a new opportunity.
Mackenzie could have been a killer, and she would have been one of a serial killer.
Wow, she always wanted to wear dresses and things like that. I mean, good on her. Like, you know, live your best life.
I cover enough Black Widows. You can definitely wear a skirt and be a killer. I'm just saying.
It is what it is. No, but I see what you're saying. But I mean, yeah, same. I wanted to work at the zoo, as a kid. And even going back and volunteering, I honestly considered if I knew I could have made a living doing that and being a part of like the zoo society and all of that stuff, I would have done that. Like I would have quit my job at Wells Fargo and gone and worked at the zoo, but it just wasn't financially an option for me.
And honestly, it still isn't. And that's unfortunately something that's going to have to change, or we're going to run into a lot of other problems, but neither here nor there. Hopefully that'll change at some point. So the remaining animals from the Predator Building are to eventually have new homes in the Alabama Wilds exhibit, which will include animals such as the golden eagle, cougars, and bobcats once it's completed. Which brings us to the next article. In an article from AL.com from August 2023 discusses the fact that the zoo had plans to expand for an additional exhibit and knew they needed to review the land and make sure any bodies buried there were removed with respect and reinterred elsewhere.
We were told there was no bodies.
Oops. Quote, nearly 120 years since the last known burial, the expansion project highlights the old cemetery as modernity bushes against the quiet, wooded, and primarily forgotten burial ground of more than 4,700 people. Wilson Fallon, professor emeritus of history at the University of Montevallo, said he's not surprised that memories of people interred at the cemetery are overlooked by history. Even in death, the poor and marginalized are historically overlooked in favor of progress, he said. Quote, those who win take advantage of the land and are the ones who are able to use the power they have to get things done, said Fallon, whose area of study include African-American history and the history of the U.S. South. And those who are poor are the ones who get taken advantage of. That's a fact of history, end quote. Mm-hmm. Today, the land formerly known as Red Mountain and Southside Cemetery houses both the zoo and the Birmingham Botanical Gardens. It's nearly impossible to know who was buried in the 12 to 15 graves that will be relocated to make way for the new zoo exhibit. Many buried there are unnamed in the old ledger of burials and were laid to rest in unmarked graves. The names, handwritten in cursive on browned, century-old paper, are often hard to decipher, yet the young ages of many of them continue to stand out on the pages. There was a person that they highlighted at the beginning of the article, and her last name was Montgomery. Montgomery was buried there on July 19, 1888. The same day, another girl, Maddie Wood, was also laid to rest. Maddie was just 3 years old. Her cause of death is listed as unknown. The ledger housed at Birmingham's Lynn Henley Research Library lists names, ages, races, causes of death, and sometimes the supervising physician in charge of the interment. The names of Montgomery and Wood are preserved in the written records, yet many more entries are entered as unknown. People buried in the Potter's Field at what was then on the edge of the Young City in the area later known as Lane Park. Quote, with the majority of this, nobody knows who is where, said Chris Pfefferkorn, president and CEO of the Birmingham Zoo. Quote, but we still want to treat the people with respect they deserve in this process. What we would like to do is not only add the marker, but we would also like to add graphics and interpretive information about the history of Lane Park and the zoo, because there's a lot of history, end quote. And then later in the article, Birmingham's old cemetery contains the remains of diverse groups of people, black and white, who largely shared a common link, being poor. Fallon said, the lack of reverence for the lives and histories of the poor, particularly the black poor, is not reserved for the South. For example, he recalled a visit to New York City about a decade ago where a 10-story building was constructed over the graves of black people. Nevertheless, Fallon called it a positive step for progress that the current zoo leadership is taking steps to right a wrong committed decades earlier by showing respect for the people interred on that property. Quote, those who are trying to preserve the bodies and location and all of that are certainly more enlightened than they were years ago, he said. That's just a fact about Birmingham. This may be a step forward, end quote.
Yes, true. But I think Birmingham has a real opportunity here to take this situation and not just use it, but to educate, like put up something that is going to explain, you know, what happened here, why did it happen, how can we prevent it, and how does, you know, things like colonization and deforestation and things like that affect not just like people, but like the local wildlife and things like that. And, you know, they have an opportunity to do something like that, not just respectfully moving bodies and trying to figure it out. You need to educate the people who are there what happened.
I agree. It's hard to know how to do that in the best way possible, but I think it's a step in the right direction, but we can definitely do more, for sure, mm-hmm. at the very least.
Yeah. I mean, it's something, and I'll give them that, but I'd like to see them use this as a way to really educate more people in that area of, you know, the harm and the damage that was done. Because that's a big topic.
Yeah, I agree.
It's still an ongoing topic.
It is. And it's not just here. It's all
it's
over
everywhere.
This nation.
Yeah. It's how poorly we treat those that are not just in the fringes, but people who are disabled, people who have mental handicaps, people who, you know, are marginalized groups, are oppressed groups. And it's
people
it's
who have been
ongoing.
Looked at in history as less than.
Yeah, all over. So I'd like to see them do something like that, incorporate it into what they're trying to build there, because it is a part of the history.
It is, of that land, and mm-hmm. it shouldn't be erased or glossed over. In a follow-up article from December of last year, the Birmingham Zoo began the process of exhuming graves for their planned expansion for the Alabama Wild exhibit. Archaeologists with the University of Alabama began working to exhume the remains from the burial site, but there was no record of the burials at the cemetery. Because of this, combined with the age of the site and burial conditions, the exhumation process was required to be done by hand, making the process even more time-consuming than it would have been otherwise. The remains were kept in climate-controlled spaces until they were to be reinterred. As of the article I found dated December 13th, 2023, 15 bodies had been exhumed. The zoo said in the article that they planned to have a service before the exhumed bodies were reinterred to show them the dignity and respect they deserve. Of course, the article brings up the fact that the places that have already been developed are quite possibly on top of burial sites and what that means for the property. I guess
I'm sure
late is better than never. Per the article on abc3340.com, quote, "It's still not completely clear whether or not there are other areas on zoo property that once served as a burial ground. We don't know because in places that have already been developed, we are unable to excavate and look for that," Pfefferkorn said. "We're looking at the sites and we're trying to improve. Our goal is to disturb as few remains as possible." The zoo is having new boxes built for any remains exhumed from the cemetery. Those same boxes will be used when reinterring the remains to the new burial site. Pfefferkorn said the zoo is also planning to host a multi-denominational service when reinterring the bodies. They also have plans to build a monument with storyboards at the new site explaining the history of those buried. The Birmingham Public Library offers a digitized archive database listing the names of everyone known to be buried at Red Mountain Cemetery as well.
That they know of, but they're not.
Well, that's what they had written, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of them, I mean, I think that was a little over 4,700, but like it said, some of them just literally say unknown. It was probably just, like we said, people that didn't have the funds to arrange for a burial. This was a potter's field. So they may not have even known who these people were, where they were from, how they died. They were the place that people went that didn't have any other option, basically.
That hurts my heart.
Or, I mean, probably people that were just found, right? That didn't have family and they were just found to be deceased and nobody knew what to do with them. So they just put them in this potter's field.
Well,
and it happened very, very commonly at that time and before that. So
yeah, I know.
This is definitely not uncommon. I mean, there were times where people would just, they would dig a huge ditch and just dump a lot of people all in one spot and cover it up and move on with their lives.
Well, I mean, anytime we've had like pandemic, epidemic, any of that stuff, that is typically what happens. Yellow fever. The first outbreak of influenza, the Black Death, like it was just mass grave and burials. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense. But it's also kind of upsetting to think that those animals are on top of graves.
Yeah, and there would be no way of knowing.
Well, the animals might know. You know what they're like.
Maybe they see them. Well, yeah, that's entirely possible. There was a couple articles that I read that they were like, well, you know, we have certain ways of scanning the land and we can see kind of what's at us up to a certain depth. We can see what's under there and certain things will show up. But even then, I mean, you're talking 100 years ago, a lot of that would be decomposed, assuming they were even in boxes of any kind to begin with. So it'd be very little left. So it would be pretty hard at this point, if something was already on top, to be able to know or really even do anything about it at this point.
Anything built on top of it, that's putting pressure on what is below it, which is going to help it degrade even faster. So, I mean, that's sad. There are ghosts walking around the Birmingham Zoo. So
probably, but they probably take care of the animals. So
probably. I mean, I never saw one, so. And I was there in the middle of the night plenty of times.
They must not be too upset, at least at the volunteers. The volunteers are okay.
Yeah.
The CEO walks around, he might get a talking to once in a while.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, that's it. That's all I got, by the way, on the history of the land for the zoo and the botanical gardens.
I didn't know any of that. I do like that they're taking it more seriously and that they are being very respectful with the remains. because they just could have ignored it, honestly. And most people just wouldn't know or care about it. So I like that they're actually owning up to it. Because everybody's probably thinking, like, why does that matter? It was 100, whatever, years ago. Like, is there even anything left? But it's more about the fact that these people were so forgotten and abused.
And these people were people.
Yeah.
I mean, they're human beings that deserve respect just like anybody else does in life and in death.
So, like, our second time around, let's not forget about them. Let's not just pretend that.
Yeah, and I actually have a link, and it'll be in the case notes, of a paper that somebody wrote, and they did a deep dive. That's where I got a lot of the information, where they like listed out where they could find each and every entry of burials of people and how many during what years and what time periods to show that there's proof, definitive proof, that there are at least that many buried there. I think it was 4,711. So 4,711 was, I think, what they could account for. So it was really fascinating. I didn't want to go that far into it, but the paper was interesting. Like, they really did their homework going through archives and stuff. Like, it's ridiculous. But
oh, I'm going to have to check.
At least somebody's paying attention and trying to pull these records to give these people the respect that they deserved.
I will say, like, Birmingham has gotten a lot better at doing, you know, things like that and recognizing past harms that they've done and trying to do better. So, yeah, I'm not surprised by this, I guess.
And I will say, I looked and looked and looked. I have not seen an update since December. So I'm assuming everything's kind of halted, probably due to lack of funding, because they frequently have that problem at the Birmingham Zoo that slows down progress on these types of
ventures.
Yeah. So I haven't heard anything recently, and they did recently lose, like, within the last year or two, we had kind of talked about it. They've lost several animals, so they may have had to reallocate funds to take care of that, as well as maybe replace some of those animals. So it's definitely something that's ongoing. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with that and how the development goes, and then what they do when they do reinter those bodies. If they do make a monument, what that's going to look like.
I'm excited for it.
Do they ever, like, do they take donations, or do they ask for donations or anything like that? Okay. I mean, I don't know if you want to share that with our listeners or not.
Yeah, we can include that. They actually had like a fundraiser specifically for this exhibit last year, and they had raised all of the funds needed for the exhibit. That's why I say I wonder if they ended up having to reallocate that money, because they lost several animals between then and now, where they're having to pay to take care of that aspect of it before that they can move forward with the exhibit, or if they're running into legal issues in getting the bodies reinterred or something along those lines. So if I do get any updates, we'll definitely release them. But yeah, we can include a link to their donation page as well.
That's really frustrating too, that they don't get the funding that they need, because Kelsey, you know, you've never been there, but the amount of wealth that is just concentrated around that area, it is astronomical. Like, it is just the wealthiest people you will ever encounter around that area. And they're just not doing anything and I'm not blanket saying that. I'm sure some of them are, but it's frustrating to me. And it's families who have had money for generations, you know, who probably benefited off of the backs of those people who are interred there, just not stepping up and helping their community. So shame on them. That's all I'm saying.
And I think we can all do better. So let's let's just do better.
Let's do better. And now I'm no longer allowed in Mountain Brook. Yay.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Wherever will
we,
I
we
get...
We visited there so often.
Another basic brunch place to eat at. Who knows?
We'll find something, I'm sure.
Well, good job. Good job. This was a weird one. But...
It was a ride.
It was a ride. That's for sure. I have very, you know, I have very strong feelings about the zoo.
Same.
Always have. Always will. Top tier for me. Top tier episode. Way to go.
Good.
Anything else to add? Are we done?
I think we're done.
Okay. Until next time. We love you. We mean it.
Okay, bye.
The Reaper.